The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of the Lawfare podcast is brought to you by Grammarly. Thanks to Grammarly for supporting the Lawfare podcast. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently by going to grammarly.com/lawfare. That's Grammarly, grammarly.com/lawfare. To get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today.
In the debates at the Constitutional Convention about impeachment, there were those who did not want an impeachment provision. An argument was made, you have to have an impeachment provision because what if a president was actually selling out to a foreign power? The prospect of re-election down the road and having to face the voters down the road wouldn't be sufficient to guard the system. It was that argument, the prospect of a president selling out to a foreign power, that switched the minds of many in Philadelphia in 1787, Gouverneur Morris and others who were arguing there shouldn't be an impeachment provision. They got persuaded to switch their minds based on exactly the scenario we're sort of grappling with, is you would not want to have a president who was engaging foreign powers in a way that would subvert the American democracy.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 3rd, 2019. Senator Tim Kaine is perhaps best known as Hillary Clinton's 2016 vice presidential running mate. For purposes of Lawfare, however, he is better understood as the Senate's leading exponent of congressional authority in the war powers domain. I sat down with Senator Kaine yesterday in his office in the Senate Russell Office Building to talk about all things war powers, the United States' new military deployment to Saudi Arabia, congressional anxieties about it, the administration's unwillingness to go to Congress for authorization, and the larger drift of congressional war powers to the executive branch. We also talked, of course, about impeachment, just a little bit. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 479, Senator Kaine on War Powers and the Coming Impeachment Trial. Senator Kaine, you sent a letter last week or the week before to Defense Secretary Esper on this deployment in Saudi Arabia. This went, I think, fair to say, largely unnoticed in the outside world, but this is a part of a long-term interest of yours in this subject. And so let's start with just tell us about the letter and about the concerns that you have about the Saudi Arabia deployment that led to it.
Yeah, glad to, Ben. So the Secretary of Defense, it's not uncommon that troops move here and there across the globe. You know, we've just got troops everywhere. What is a little less common is that when a troop movement happens, that the Secretary of Defense sends us a letter and says, I'm giving you notice pursuant to the War Powers Act. So when you get a letter like that, you shouldn't just assume, oh, it's just casual. That means something. When they need to give us a war powers notification when they move troops, in this case it was air squadrons to Saudi Arabia, that should tell us, okay, this is seen by the DOD as something more momentous. So I wrote a letter to Secretary Esper. The troop movement was announced, I think, on the 19th of November, and I wrote him a letter within the last 10 days saying, I noticed that you're doing this. why do we need to position more troops there to defend Saudi Arabia when we've sold them all these weapons, when they have a defense capacity? What's really going on here? Secretary Nesper and I spoke about 4 days ago when he said, okay, got the letter. We want to come in and brief you on the answers to those questions. And I'm hoping that it will be a briefing that I'll be able to get other members of the Armed Services and maybe the Foreign Relations Committees to come to as well, because we haven't really been told why is this necessary and why was it necessary for you to give us the notice pursuant to the War Powers Act to talk about the movement of these troops. My surmise is that the administration is trying to position a lot more assets in Saudi Arabia to potentially protect the Saudis from an incursion by Iran of the kind that was done a couple months ago when Iran attacked some of the Saudi oil infrastructure. But the notion that the U.S. should be the guarantor of Saudi's defense, wait a minute, we're not in a treaty with them. They're not part of NATO. There's no congressionally approved state of affairs where we would guarantee the Saudi defense. In fact, the congressional relationship with Saudi Arabia right now, after the murder of Khashoggi, after the jailing of women's rights activists, after the horrible misprosecution of the war in Yemen, the congressional desire to sort of guarantee the defense of Saudi Arabia is frankly not real high. And the president shouldn't believe for a minute that he can use U.S. military to defend Saudi Arabia without getting congressional permission.
Well, so he shouldn't believe for a minute, except that presidents increasingly believe that they can do all kinds of things for a little bit more than a minute.
Especially this one, but not only this one, you're right.
But not only this one. Right. In the war powers arena, it's been a pretty steady accretion of ambition on the executive's part across administration, and a relatively few small number of legislators, yourself among them on a consistent basis, has been anxious about it, or at least people have imagined themselves anxious, but the institution, including this half of the institution, has kind of never really managed to do anything
right
about it.
Right.
And so I'm, as a practical matter, if I'm President Trump, why shouldn't I think for a minute that I can do this without congressional approval? It's like, I can do it without Tim Kaine saying, don't think you can do it without congressional approval.
But what about the whole body?
What about the actual Senate and the actual House?
Well, no, look, you're right. I don't think this president believes Congress can get in his way on anything. You know, we won't respond to congressional subpoenas. He tells witnesses they don't need to. He takes money out of the Pentagon budget to use for a border wall that his defense establishment all says is not a military emergency. He will withhold congressionally mandated aid to Ukraine. So he doesn't believe that we have any power regardless. But you're right. Other presidents have, in the war powers area, sort of asserted themselves and dared Congress to stop them. The reason this one might be a little bit different is Congress has shown some backbone in the last year about matters with respect to Saudi Arabia. So, for example, on two areas, Congress, by overwhelming majorities, put on the president's desk a bill saying, hey, we shouldn't be involved in prosecuting this horrible civil war in Yemen. And we basically forced the White House to stop using U.S. military assets to refuel Saudi aircraft on bombing runs into Yemen. Interestingly enough, the president vetoed the resolution, but then they stopped doing the refueling. We couldn't override the veto, but we actually did cause a course correction in the U.S. activity in the Saudi prosecution of the war in Yemen. Secondly, a majority of both bodies have rebuked the Saudis on arms sales because of the death of Khashoggi. Again, the president vetoed that, and didn't have the votes to override. But Congress is starting to show some backbone around this issue of, hold on a second, when it comes to kind of war powers issues in Saudi Arabia, you're going too far. I do know this. I know the will of my colleagues. My colleagues do not want to be in another war in the Middle East. My Virginians, we're one of the most military states in the country, they do not want to be in another war in the Middle East. And if the president is, by deploying more troops to Saudi Arabia in the midst of this maximum pressure campaign against Iran, is kind of blundering us closer and closer to being involved in another war in the Middle East, a war to protect Saudi Arabia, where I would argue that homeland interests of the United States are not directly implicated in a long-term feud between Saudi Arabia and Iran, that I suspect you would see a higher level of anxiety, agitation toward an administration that would basically try to assert that the U.S. might need to be positioned for war to protect Saudi Arabia. I don't think that's where Congress is right now.
And when you say your colleagues and Congress, are you including in that Republicans in the Senate?
Yes.
So you think there is there would be bipartisan anxiety that would, if offered the opportunity, decline to authorize a deployment to Saudi Arabia?
I would, and I'll give you the counter to what I'm going to tell you, but there was strong bipartisan support that the U.S. shouldn't be involved in the civil war in Yemen, at least militarily involved. We had crossed the line in the War Powers Authority. What we were doing with Saudi Arabia was involving us in the war. A strong bipartisan majority said we shouldn't be doing that. Strong bipartisan support to rebuke and stop arms sales to the Saudis after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist, Virginia resident. People like Lindsey Graham, you know, were very, very forceful on this, standing up against the president when in the past they usually support the president. So I think the notion that the U.S. should just kind of imperceptibly slide into a position where we're now just going to be the guarantors of the defense of Saudi Arabia, I think would be objected to greatly in Congress by both parties. The one element that Republicans, you know, often rally around is if there's anything to do against Iran, they're going to be for whatever's against Iran. But even with that attitude, an anti-Iranian attitude, I just don't see the Republicans right now having the appetite to involve the United States in another war in the Middle East. And the maximum pressure campaign that this administration is foolishly, in my view, waging against Iran has raised the risk of war in the Middle East. And that's something the president said he would not do when he was a candidate. We need to be moving away from wars in the Middle East, not getting involved in more of them. And I think Republicans would also understand that their constituents do not want us to be there.
And is your view, I think your view is both, but I want to make sure, mm-hmm. is your view here that you oppose any such deployment without congressional authorization, or that you oppose any such deployment without congressional authorization and you would not vote to authorize it if given the chance, or is it both, right?
It's a little bit both, right? It is a little bit both. I don't think we should be getting into a war or even kind of blundering close to a war without congressional authorization. Absent imminent defense of the United States, Congress is supposed to be involved. And the War Powers Resolution even talks about Congress being able to take action either after the initiation of war or when war seems imminent or likely. I think Congress has to be consulted and actually has to vote and put their imprimatur on it. In this case, however, I'd make the second argument that you ask. I just do not think the U.S. should be the defense guarantor of the Saudis. We've sold them weaponry. That's fine. They are an ally. That's fine. But the notion that if they can't manage their relationship with Iran, that we then have to come in and be their guarantor in a proxy war that's going on throughout the Middle East, I find highly troubling. And I can't see the circumstance in which I would vote for the U.S. to be the sort of guarantor of the defense of Saudi Arabia against Iran. They need to be put to the test, and Iran does too, to try to manage that relationship. But for them to expect that the U.S. would come in and be their defense guarantor, there's no treaty that requires us to do that. Their behavior does not justify us taking that position to protect them.
What about Syria? So in the case of Syria, where there was a fair bit, I think it's fair to say, of kind of war powers congressionalists had a certain anxiety about the U.S. deployment in Syria.
I definitely did.
And yet there was outrage, including, I think, from you, at the sort of sudden redeployment or you know, announcement that right. the president made and abandonment of the Kurds in the context of the last couple months. And so I guess my question is, how do you square those?
Oh, that's a great question.
Like the, you know, they shouldn't be there, have been there in the first place without congressional authorization. And by the way, you shouldn't withdraw them either.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. When President Obama began the mission against ISIS in Syria and northern Iraq, I said, I could certainly vote for this, but you should come to us for a vote. So I was critical of both administrations for prosecuting the war against ISIS in Iraq and northern Syria without a fresh authorization. I didn't believe the 2001 authorization covered it. Now, I was also critical of President Trump when he abandoned the Kurds. Why? Because you don't abandon a battlefield ally and give nobody notice. You just don't do that. People won't trust the United States. There had been no briefing of Congress. There had been no discussion of, okay, here's the equities right now in northern Syria. We think this is the best step to take. And finally, even if you were to agree with the president's rationale, because I did hear both Secretaries Esper and General Milley, the head of the Joint Chiefs, give a logical rationale for why in that space in northern Syria it made some sense for the U.S. to back off. Why would the president say, and the Kurds are no angels, and sort of trash the Kurds when they had been the best allies we had in the fight against ISIS? You don't publicly trash your allies and cozy up to your adversaries, which is what this president does again and again and again. So we shouldn't have been engaged in that war at all, in my view, absent a congressional authorization, which would have been relatively easy, I think, to obtain, because ISIS is a bad guy and Congress would have been glad to pass an anti-ISIS vote. But having made common cause with the Kurds, we shouldn't have surprised them, surprised Congress, surprised our NATO allies. The U.S. had just convinced the U.K. and France to commit more troops to help us fight ISIS in northern Syria and partner with the Kurds shortly before the U.S. then announced we were going to separate from the Kurds. We want people who can count on us. That is the key to the reputation of the United States. You know, I want to be the nation that people can count on. When we tell you we're with you, we're with you. And if we're not with you, then you got to count on that too. What the president has done is made this all up in the air, unpredictable. That's not the way the world's great superpower should act.
Thanks to Grammarly for supporting our podcast. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. It encourages everyone, even the best students, top professionals, and the very finest national security law blog editors to do their best work and accomplish even more of their goals. Grammarly is a writing assistant that I use to make myself look and sound smarter. You too will easily improve yourself and your communication at school, work, and just about anywhere else with Grammarly. So I use Grammarly to help me reply quickly to emails without embarrassing myself, which I am prone to do without some kind of electronic aid. I really enjoy how Grammarly spots my mistakes and flags them with a flashing red underline. It's kind of cool. And offers helpful suggested changes so I can rifle through my inbox more quickly and confidently with Grammarly on my side. And you can too. Grammarly helps people show their best self through writing and is available across platforms, including an online browser extension, a desktop editor, and a mobile keyboard checker. Grammarly is available on Chrome, Firefox, Safari, and Edge browsers, and on platforms like iOS, Android, Windows, and Mac. The free product reviews critical spelling and grammar, and Grammarly Premium looks out for spelling and grammar plus advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, and readability for different occasions, like a business proposal, an academic essay, or a Lawfare blog post. So accomplish your goals with help from Grammarly. Stop making email typos on your phone. Close more deals at work this year with better emails. Polish your resume to get that new job. So use Grammarly and personalize your experience. You can change the settings to write for different occasions like work, school, or creative writing. And Grammarly can remember new words too. I've been using Grammarly, and just in the past week alone, I've saved myself from sending a bunch of embarrassing emails, not to mention Twitter posts, and I need some help on that front. So go to Grammarly.com/lawfare to get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. That's Grammarly, Grammarly.com/lawfare for 20% off your Grammarly premium account. All right, so let's zoom way out, and you've described in a whole bunch of discrete areas what best war powers practices on the part of the executive and the legislature shouldn't look like.
Right.
But
they shouldn't look like.
Yeah, I want to get a sense of, and I you and I have spoken about this a fair bit over the years.
Yep.
But like, what is the war powers
the view of the way the war powers world should work, according to Tim Kaine. You've almost, since you've been in the Senate, you've been trying to get the 2001 AUMF rewritten or updated. So, like, what's the underlying vision behind all of these discrete legislative efforts that you've engaged in over the years?
Yeah, I really think it's what the framers envisioned the Constitution, and I'll tell you that, and then I'll make it current. What would I do right now? So I think the framers tried to strike a balance that did involve some necessary ambiguity. The balance was Congress should be the body that initiates war, and that would make the United States different than virtually any other country where war is for the executive. We'd make the initiation of war for the legislative. However, once initiated, it would be a drag to have 535 commanders-in-chief. You have to give the president the power once initiated to structure the military action. So to initiate a war, you should have a vote of Congress. Now, the ambiguity was this. President's the commander-in-chief. Congress used to meet a few months a year, and then everybody would ride horseback back to Vermont. President had to have the ability to defend the nation. So in the event of an imminent attack on the U.S., ongoing or imminent attack, and you have to give the president some flexibility in terms of what would be an imminent attack, the president can act prior to congressional authorization, but should then come to Congress seeking ratification. I think that is clearly what the framers intended. Of the things in the Constitution, some are vague. What is an unreasonable search and seizure? Some are specific. You have to be 35 years old to be president. The war powers is actually more toward the specific than the vague side. Neither party, Whig, Federalist, Republican, Democrat, have really followed it. Congresses haven't. Presidents haven't. Because Congress is chicken, and they would rather foist it off on the president if they can. But there's a reason that the framers put it in place, and that was before we send our troops into harm's way, they should only go there if it's with the imprimatur of a debated in public vote that, yes, this mission is in the national interest. Now, how should that look currently? I think that there's basically two kinds of war powers questions that we have to grapple with right now. War against a nation state, and that I think that has to have a traditional declaration of war. Nation states generally follow Geneva Conventions. You don't have to stress out too much when you're defining the war against a nation state in terms of what the geography is or what's the definition of the party you're going against. So any war against a nation state should require a traditional declaration of war passed by Congress. What Al-Qaeda and ISIS presented, though not for the first time in our history, Barbary Coast Pirates in the 1790s, what they presented is, okay, if the war is not against a nation state, so there isn't a fixed geography, and there isn't even a fixed name of the group because they can morph, change, and splinter, and the groups don't follow Geneva Conventions and things like that, the definitional problems do get more complicated. And that's why a couple of years ago, Senator Corker and I wrote up what we considered kind of a rewrite of the 2001 authorization, but also sort of establishing a process going forward for if you're going to be engaged in military action against a non-state actor, what is the back and forth between the executive and Congress and how should it be done? Some thought it was interesting. Some on the left thought that gave too much credence to the executive. The Trump administration hated it because they realized it tied their hands a good bit compared to the 2001 authorization and how they're using it. But I think we probably need to recognize that wars kind of come in two flavors right now, the war against a nation state and the war against a non-state actor. And Congress needs a role in both and needs to vote to ratify military action in either case. But the way you get at it probably needs to be slightly different in each case.
And do you think that your view is over time prevailing on this? Or when you look at this, do you see yourself as a sort of quixotic figure with, you know, the ever larger windmills that you're tilting at?
I do think my view, and it's not really my view. I actually got interested in this when I was governor of Virginia, and the Miller Center at the University of Virginia had a really compelling stakeholder group that included former secretaries of state and defense and others talking about the unworkability of the 1973 War Powers Resolution, how it should be rewritten. But I think that the view that Congress should reclaim this power is being taken more and more seriously by more and more members, Democratic and Republican, partly because I think the more we talk about it over time, we persuade people, but also partly when you've lived under this 2001 authorization, it's one thing to have lived under it for 5 years or 10 years, but when you get to you're now justifying military actions around the globe in dozens of countries 20 years later, under a vaguely worded 60-word authorization, people are more and more troubled by it. Add to it that this president, compared to President Obama, I thought he asserted himself and did things via an executive that he needed Congress for. But he tended to do it in a fairly careful and discreet and defined way. This president, President Trump, uses that precedent. We'll see, the president can do it, but he uses it for things that aren't carefully defined, that are way too expansive, and that I think people see that and they're more worried about it than they were under President Obama.
All of which is a great transition to ask you briefly about Ukraine and the impending, I think it's fair to say, impending impeachment trial that you are going to sit on as a juror/trier of fact. I won't ask you about your views of the merits of the matter, because I understand you don't, given your role, not comfortable talking about
that. Until it gets to us and I take that oath to weigh all facts fairly, I'm trying to be scrupulous about that.
But I do want to ask you about the sort of substance of the allegations vis-a-vis foreign policy. This is the first impeachment that is centrally about foreign policy and international affairs and the conduct of the presidency in interaction with foreign governments. And I'm curious, as we've talked about, congressional regulation of the president's military authorities overseas.
Yep.
We're also seeing an impeachment trial that is itself a form of regulation of the president's non-military activities overseas. I'm curious for your thoughts on that.
No, you stated it correctly. I mean, this is the fourth sort of impeachment instance: Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton, now Donald Trump. And it's the first one that really is about foreign policy and the role of America in the world. First, this is an impeachment inquiry that had to happen, because if you look at the Mueller report, President Trump really ducked a bullet in that. The two areas of inquiry: was there obstruction of justice? Well, here's all the evidence, but we can't indict a sitting president on that, so set that aside. Was there coordination with a foreign government to subvert an American election? Well, Russia did try to subvert an American election, and President Trump publicly urged them to help him, but the Mueller report found insufficient evidence of coordination. But they clearly said, that's a red line, you can't do that. Well, literally, within days after that report came out, which should have been instructive to anybody who had doubts, okay, you can't get a foreign government involved to try to help you win an election, the Trump team is doing that very thing with Ukraine. So the inquiry needed to go forward. Second, the bits of evidence that are swirling around: was it okay to sack a wonderful career ambassador and, essentially libel her to the president of Ukraine and in tweets to the world and say she's bad news? Is it okay to hand off foreign policy with respect to Ukraine to a citizen, Rudy Giuliani, that the Senate has no oversight ability to control? There's a lot of foreign policy questions that are wrapped up in this. And basically, if you really look at the inquiry, it's sort of got four pieces to it that are all very serious. Did the president abuse his office to help him win an election by thwarting the will of Congress, mandated appropriations to help Ukraine, by hurting an ally that we were pledged to help, and in doing so, helping an adversary, Russia? So this whole thing, abuse of power, thwarting the will of Congress, hurting an ally, helping an adversary, these are four big issues. And the last thing I'll say, Ben, is this. In the debates at the Constitutional Convention about impeachment, there were those who did not want an impeachment provision. An argument was made, you have to have an impeachment provision, because what if a president was actually selling out to a foreign power? The prospect of re-election down the road and having to face the voters down the road wouldn't be sufficient to guard the system. It was that argument, the prospect of a president selling out to a foreign power, that switched the minds of many in Philadelphia in 1787, Gouverneur Morris and others who were arguing there shouldn't be an impeachment provision. They got persuaded to switch their minds based on exactly the scenario we're sort of grappling with, is you would not want to have a president who was engaging foreign powers in a way that would subvert the American democracy.
And when you think about you've described several distinct issues here. One of them is the way foreign policy is conducted.
Yes.
But the other is the substance of what is conducted in doing foreign policy, right?
Right.
Are you using the State Department or are you using Rudy Giuliani? But also, what are you demanding of other countries?
Right.
Are these questions that in your mind have red lines, or are they questions that, as you think of it, there's a lot of gray area between the legitimate and the illegitimate,
yeah,
but there's some point beyond which is not debatable.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's more gray area in the how foreign policy gets conducted than there is on how should war be declared. I think how should war be declared is very constitutionally Congress should do it. You get into the conduct of foreign policy, I actually think president should have more latitude to do it. If it deals with an appropriation of money, that has to happen from Congress. It deals with a ratification of a treaty, that has to happen in the Senate. But unless they're the things that only Congress can do, or Congress very specifically is sort of directed to do, I think the president should have a lot of ability to conduct foreign policy, you know, reporting and hopefully keeping Congress informed. But I give the president, for example, a lot of latitude in the negotiations and discussions they're having with North Korea. I think that's a very good thing. Hadn't amounted to anything yet, but that's North Korea's fault, not the U.S.'s fault. And so I think the president needs that latitude. But there are some things where, like when Congress says, hey, you're mandated to spend this money to defend our ally. And the president is like, yeah, I know, but I'm not doing it anyway. That's crossing a red line.
All right. So I want to close with this kind of one question that's been bugging me for a long time. If we're all in gray area here, where, you know, where there's some zone outside of
right.
it that's just completely beyond the pale, but actually, you know, does the president want to send his personal lawyer as his kind of special envoy to a foreign country? In principle, there's something irregular about that, but irregular isn't per se impeachable.
That's true.
For a certain, you know, right? You know, if everything depends on a kind of state of mind, corrupt state of mind
right.
distinction, how well positioned is the Senate as an institution to evaluate, given the partisan division
yeah.
of the Senate, to do a fair evaluation and a sort of rigorous evaluation of kind of scienter questions in complex fact patterns?
Scienter, for the folks listening at home, is state of mind. Is there an evil state of mind? That's what scienter means. So, look, we're charged to do that by the oath that we take. Whether we're well positioned to do it or not because of partisanship doesn't really matter. We're charged to do it by the oath we take. And I'll tell you, what I use, probably, you know, the just a great bit of testimony we had in the Foreign Relations Committee a few weeks ago. John Sullivan, the number two guy at State, was here because he's been nominated to become our ambassador to Russia. And he was asked a question that really got at that. And he basically was asked about the transcript of the call between President Trump and President Zelensky on July 25th. And he said, look, if President Trump was asking President Zelensky to take the issue of corruption in Ukraine seriously, that's perfectly, perfectly reasonable. If, on the other hand, he was asking President Zelensky to investigate a political rival to help his own election, that is completely contrary to our values. I think that's the question. And I actually think there's a lot of evidence on the table from which you can make a decision about that question. Now, the question, you have to really make two decisions. Was the behavior wrong? And then was it sufficiently wrong to be impeachable? But I go back to the point that I made earlier. President Trump had been warned. You know, the way to look at the Mueller report is, okay, you know, this is the report. There's no action against you now, but you have been warned about what is the right and the wrong side of this line to be on. And one thou shalt not that was very clear in the Mueller report, you cannot involve a foreign government trying to help you win an election, thereby subverting American democracy. John Sullivan laid it out real clearly. If it was an effort to encourage Ukraine to deal with corruption issues, that's fine. But if it was an effort to dig up dirt on a political opponent, that's completely contrary to our values.
And with all the, with everything you've seen in the war powers arena, you're comfortable with the competence of this body to try the case?
Yes. I mean,
there's no choice.
Yeah,
but
there's no choice. And I might not like the outcome, but we are charged with doing it. I will say I am a little bit struck by the partisan nature of this at this point. You know, remember, this was fascinating. Nixon won in a landslide in 1972. He was inaugurated in January. I think he got 63% of the vote. In February, the Senate voted to start an inquiry into the Watergate break-in and all the circumstances. The Senate voted, and it was a unanimous vote. Some Republicans abstained, but there were no votes. So just think about it. It was clear that the Watergate break-in didn't help Nixon win. He won by a landslide. But enough Republicans cared about the integrity of our electoral process that they said, we have to initiate this inquiry. Not a single one of them voted no. That's not the political reality that we're living in now, and that's a shame. Bill Ruckel's house just died, you know, within the last week. Republican credentials just absolutely rock solid. First director of the EPA, acting director of the FBI, deputy attorney general. But when President Nixon, who Ruckel's house knew very, very well, said, fire Archibald Cox, the attorney general, Ellett Richardson, said, I'm not firing the special prosecutor, I'm resigning. Then Nixon went to Ruckel's house. He said, I'm not firing Cox, and I'm going to resign. And eventually Bork fired him. There were Republicans in 1974 who were willing to stand up to the president of their own party and say, you've gone too far. I have less confidence in that today. But we are going to take this oath, if it comes our way, that we will fully and fairly weigh all the facts. And that includes talking to each other and in dialogue with each other. It's a somber thing to contemplate.
Senator Kaine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Michaela Fogel, our redoubtable audio engineer who trekked out to the Senate with me bearing communications equipment. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, to tweet about the Lawfare Podcast, including to people who don't know what the word CNTER means. You need to share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook and particularly on Pinterest, where Lawfare is sadly underrepresented. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan, who will be on Rational Security tomorrow in the Jungle Studio. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.